Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo, back from the dead. And
we are near dead,
I was telling you. But we are so happy to be back. And
we're very happy to be back. We feel very fortunate and lucky to have Leo back.
And tonight we have an interview with Ellen Brown, who is a journalist and author, and she's going to be talking to us about the Federal Reserve, and how we can possibly set up our own state banks, save our economies, and we're going to get into that. We've got about 40 minutes with her, so we're going to get into that in a few minutes. But in the meantime, we got some stuff here that I'd like to talk about. What do you think there, Tony? What do you think?
What do you have there?
I don't know.
Lots of videos and lots of audio.
Thanksgiving, go ahead to pay unlimited bonuses.
Well, that might be interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to. That's European stuff.
It's
all the same everywhere. But
and floods in Australia.
Yep. And let's see. We've heard all this. U.S. government to Europe, give this to your people or there will be some pain.
All right. Yeah, let's see what that is.
I don't know. It's 12 minutes of shit.
Oh, Monsanto.
Oh.
Genetically modified crops.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to go 12 minutes into
Monsanto.
No. All right. Tone down the rhetoric, Mr. President. Hate speech zone ahead. Okay. No, that's all that. We know that the guy, you know, just shot his nut, just shot.
The use of words, Gabby, the use of words and phrases like take aim, reload, and shoot down, despite their metaphorical intention, is to blame for the random act of violence committed by one psychopath in America on Sunday, according to scores of frothing media hacks and political lawmakers. If this is so, why not highlight a speech given by then-presidential candidate Obama in 2008, in which he triumphantly stated, if they bring a knife to the fight, we bring a gun. Obama made the comments at a fundraiser in Philadelphia in June 2008 in the run-up to the November elections as he squared off against John McCain for the presidency.
Of course, John McCain said, bomb, 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 Iran. So it's like, you know, yeah, we got we got a couple of morons who ran for election here, but
the use of words and phrases like take aim, reload, and shoot down, despite their metaphorical intention. Oh, okay. From what I understand of folks in Philly, like a good brawl. I've seen Eagles fans, Obama added at the time, referring to the political battle his party and the GOP were waging. Of course, these are just words used metaphorically and illustratively. Obama did not mean he was going to gun down John McCain in cold blood any more than Sarah Palin meant she wished her supporters to go out and literally kill her political opponents. To any rational and sane person, even having this debate is completely asinine. However, the seizure upon the Arizona shooting for political point scoring, mostly by the left-leaning hacks and politicians, has centered upon literally blaming the political and ideological opponents' words in a desperate and despicable attempt to use the actions of a psychopath as a way of giving precedence to their political agenda.
MSNBC's Keith Olbermann comments provide an overview of the kind of unmitigated crap that is being spewed to this end. He says, if there are crosshairs over a congresswoman's name in October and a former vice presidential candidates congratulating herself on her bullseye campaign in November, and on a Friday, the congresswoman trades emails with a Republican about the need to tap down the divisiveness and rhetoric, and on the Saturday, she gets shot using a gun magazine that would have been unavailable if the assault weapons ban hadn't expired, the idea of coincidence becomes increasingly irrelevant. The crazed do not need much to set them off. And that's right. You see, leaving aside the fact that there is no indication he had any discernible cause, Jared Loughner, or whatever, was pushed over the edge of their words, rhetoric, vitriol, extremism, the climate of hate. So naturally, I was right all along, and my political agenda should be advanced. And Obermann's sentiments have been amplified tenfold by leftist bloggers, and in a sickeningly ironic turn of events, have translated into a call for more violence on behalf of half-wit Twitters.
Sorry, Twitters. Keith, at all. It doesn't hold up. The fact that the status left-wing blog Daily Kos used identical bullseye rhetoric has also been quietly ignored. The following comments by Martin Medhurst, a Baylor University professor of rhetoric and communications, in a Washington Post article, sums up this sorry state of affairs succinctly. We have 24-hour coverage, and if you let your political opposition have 12 or 15 hours unanswered, they have already determined what the conclusion of the story is. To the extent we politicize tragedy, whether it's the left or the right, it's unfortunate, but it has to be because of the system we live in. The great danger to emerge from this frothing insanity is the potential for such opportunists to pitch solutions that, in any normal context, would be immediately identified as intrinsically harmful to a free society and everyone's way of life throughout the country and across the political spectrum.
The fallout of this tragedy highlights just how much of a death grip the false left-right political paradigm has on the nation. Any significant event is now distorted beyond all comprehension and used to whip up yet more divisive and polarization among the American people, and that's just the way the elite power structure likes it. And
this
Steve Watson, he's right. You know, he's right on that. But at the same time, you know, I think it's absolutely foolish to think that what we're saying, what anyone is saying, had anything to do with it, with this guy targeting Gifford in Arizona. I mean, you know, for one thing, Arizona is a crazy state anyway. Okay, Arizona, you can go out and you can buy a gun anywhere. Okay, you don't even have to register the damn thing, and you can carry it around. You can carry it concealed. It's totally legal to do that. And you know, and so I mean, anybody's a target in Arizona. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
And the gun laws there are no gun laws. So it's like, you know, who's kidding who? You know, at least in other states, those things are recognized. And if all of these knock-kneed, spineless congressmen and senators are so afraid now to meet the public, well, you know, give up your freaking jobs. Give them to somebody that has the balls to go out and do the job, or carry your own weapon. You know what I mean? Or get your own security people. I mean, hey. The amazing thing is that almost every major celebrity has to have security. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You can't have a performance without it. What, these guys think they're freaking invincible? You know, they're like super dudes because they have health insurance.
I guess.
They've been elected. Hope everybody loves them. Well, that's not true.
The most passion and energy I've seen from Boehner has been because he's scared to death.
He's scared to death of his own. You know, he's afraid to walk out of his own office, and he starts bawling. He starts crying every time he turns. You know. Turn on the faucets every time he's got to talk now. You know, I was like,
we should feel sorry for
him. I mean, these are Republican wimps. But, come on.
It doesn't matter whether he's Republican or Democrat.
It doesn't matter.
Like,
part of it. I mean, if you're afraid to meet the people that have elected you, that's your problem. If I was an elected citizen, elected official, don't you think I'd have a freaking gun? Of course I'd have a gun on me. All right, look what happened to everybody. Look at the, like, good God.
No, I don't approve of that.
I would have a gun. I'd have three or four security guards
I think it's really stupid.
Especially if I was a controversial politician. Why not?
You know, listening,
I'm going to get my head blown off.
I wouldn't carry a gun.
I'd go out there, but I wouldn't do it without security.
Leo, just let me have two words.
Well, you know, I don't believe that.
You don't have to agree with me. I don't believe it.
Yeah, you go out there and get your head blown off by Gifford.
You're not listening. Because you keep talking, you don't
okay,
give me a
ahead.
Chance to
go
say
ahead.
Anything.
All right.
I wouldn't carry a gun, but I think it's smart to have security.
Yeah.
Okay,
well,
I would like to go on to...
It's a good idea to have a gun as well. Yeah.
No, I would hesitate, so he who hesitates loses.
I think
it causes more problems than you need.
Yeah,
anyway, CIA created Frankenstein, U.S. turns blind eye on terrorists. I'm interested in this.
CIA created Frankenstein. U.S. turns blind eye.
Okay.
Wanted for terror, being tried on minor fraud charges.
Let's see what this
A former CIA operative who is wanted in Venezuela and Cuba for terrorist attacks throughout Latin America has gone on trial in the U.S. But that's not why Luis Posada Torrijos is in court. Instead, he's being charged with lying to immigration officers. RT's Jihan Hafiz looks at why the U.S. is turning a blind eye to an alleged terrorist.
Miami, Florida. White sand beaches, miniskirts, and bikinis. This vacation spot is also home to a convicted international terrorist, Luis Posada Carriles. Coined the Bin Laden of the Americas, the anti-Castro Cuban was the CIA's dirty secret in South and Central America. Trained as an explosives expert at the notorious School of the Americas, Posada's acts of terrorism spanned 5 decades and impacted half a dozen countries. Over 70 people were killed when Cubana airliner 455 was bombed in 1976. A terrorist act Posada plans from Venezuela, and according to CIA documents, the agency was aware of it before it happened.
Posada Carriles was the mastermind of the bombing of the Cubana flight, and still he's here.
Posada was convicted in absentia in Venezuela of masterminding the bombing. However, not only did the U.S. government refuse to extradite Posada to Venezuela to serve his term, the CIA continued to employ him as a key element in the Contra Wars, which claimed the lives of 70,000 civilians in Nicaragua. He was a leading figure in the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s. Had the CIA stopped Posada in his tracks,
just stopped in my shoes. My brother was killed.
Livia Di Silmo's brother, Fabio, would still be alive.
Put yourself in the place of a victim of a family, victim of terrorism, and it's absurd.
Di Silmo, an Italian businessman, was murdered in a 1997 bombing orchestrated by Posada. It was one of a string of hotel and nightclub bombings in Cuba. Di Silmo describes Posada as
a monster created by a country that is their government officials to push their agenda are willing to go any route.
After jailing Posada upon entering the U.S. illegally, law enforcement agencies warned the Justice Department of Posada's terrorist past, but he was set free anyway. Now Posada is on trial in El Paso, Texas. The charges against him, not international terrorism, but immigration fraud and perjury.
We unleashed him on the world.
Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archives obtained dozens of documents pertaining to Posada's involvement with the CIA. He says the case is about
whether the United States truly can hold real terrorists, although in this case a terrorist who was once our terrorist, accountable.
Livio acknowledges the importance of Posada on trial, but insists
it's going to be too little too late.
And it wasn't the only acts of terrorism Posada was involved in. There was the 2000 assassination attempt on Cuban leader Fidel Castro and a series of attacks across Latin America.
The legacy of Luis Posada is that he is a CIA-created Frankenstein, and he went out and committed murder and mayhem.
The CIA once described Posada as a reliable asset to the U.S. government, a man of good character, pro-U.S., who would make an excellent official in a post-Castro government.
Their evaluation of him could not have been more mistaken.
Half a century after Posada Carriles began doing the CIA's dirty work in Latin America, his bloody legacy lives on for the countless victims. And as the U.S. government continues to fight the so-called war on terrorism, extraditing, kidnapping, and assassinating suspects in other countries, it continues to harbor one of the hemisphere's most notorious terrorists. Jahan Hafiz, RT, Washington, D.C.
Okay.
All right. Do we need to know things like that?
Yeah.
Let's hope they don't acquit him and give him asylum here.
Yeah, I'm sure they probably will.
He'll take up residence in Texas.
Yeah. And be, hang out with the dead Bin Laden. We're going to go to, there's something here I wanted to see. Or read. 8 conspiracy theories about health. that the mainstream media has been forced to admit are actually true.
Let's go down to that list.
Yeah.
Let's find out what those...
Yeah, well, that's what I'm going to do here.
See what that
list... what we're doing.
It takes a minute to bring it up. 8 conspiracy theories about health...
Yeah. All right. 8 conspiracy theories. I just read that. Okay.
Yeah. Following...
Wait. Okay, this is from the American Dream. All right. Who knows more about health, the mainstream media or those that believe in conspiracy theories? Well, the truth is that time after time after time, those in the alternative media and those who believe in conspiracy theories have been proven to be far ahead of those in the mainstream media when it comes to matters of health. Sadly, the mainstream media receives so much funding and so many advertising dollars from the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industry, the big chemical companies, and the health insurance industry, that they are extremely cautious to report any information that would be harmful to any of them. So for years, the mainstream media generally refused to talk about the dangers posed by such things as fluoride, aspartame, prescription drugs, genetically modified foods, and cell phones. But now the alternative media has been making so much noise about many of these health issues for so long that the mainstream media has been forced to acknowledge that some of these conspiracy theories about health are actually true.
Not that the mainstream media was all of a sudden turning their backs on the financial giants that are pumping billions of dollars into them, but the truth is that we are starting to see just a little bit more honesty in reporting about health issues from the mainstream media these days. The following 8 conspiracy theories about health are...
That the mainstream media has been forced to admit are actually true.
Okay. Number 1, high levels of fluoride in our drinking water is bad. Amazingly, the U.S. government has now come out and is lowering the recommended amount of fluoride in our drinking water for the first time in 50 years. Of course, it would be great if they just banned fluoride in drinking water altogether, but the government, to even admit that the high levels of fluoride could be a problem is a huge step.
In a recent article on the CNN, it was reported that the federal government is now saying that high levels of fluoride in the water has now officially been linked with fluorosis. The Department of Health and Human Services and Environmental Protection are proposing the change because of an increase of fluorosis, a condition that causes spotting and streaking on children's teeth. Number 2, once we allowed genetically modified crops to be used, they would spread everywhere.
For years, many of us have been trying to warn people that genetically modified crops are incredibly dangerous. Now a very prominent newspaper in the UK is admitting that a very specific insecticide that is grown inside of genetically modified corn is rapidly getting into the water of the surrounding environment.
The insecticide is the product of a bacterial gene inserted into the GM maize and other cereal crops to protect them against insects such as the European corn borer beetle. And scientists have detected the insecticide in a significant number of streams draining the Great Corn Belt of the American Midwest.
So that's pretty serious.
Yeah.
Number 3, there are pharmaceutical drugs and cancer-causing chemicals in our drinking water. Over the past couple of years, the mainstream media has actually begun reporting on all of the nasty things that are now showing up in our water. For example, do you remember a highly carcinogenic chemical known as hexylvalent chromium? That was made famous by the movie Aaron Brockovich. Well, just a few weeks ago, the Washington Post reported that high levels of it has been found in the drinking water of 31 U.S. cities.
An environmental group that analyzed the drinking water in 35 cities across the United States, include Bethesda and Washington, found that most contained hexavalent chromium, a probable carcinogen that was made famous by the film Aaron Brockovich. But not only is there hexavalent chromium in our drinking water, the truth is that there are thousands of other chemicals and prescription drugs in our water supply, as a Time magazine article from a few months ago described.
All told, there are 3,000 prescription pharmaceuticals in use in the U.S. and thousands more over-the-counter drugs, not to mention creams and ointments we smear on and then shower off. Between cosmetics, pharmaceuticals, and other sources, says John Spatz, commissioner of Chicago's Department of Water Management, there are 80,000 potential combinations of chemicals. It's impossible to keep our drinking water supply from a gusher like that.
And number four is cell phones are linked to cancer. The mainstream media is not quite ready to come out and openly declare that cell phones cause cancer. But at least now they are beginning to report on the results of some very disturbing studies that seem to suggest a link between the two. For example, just consider the following sentence from one recent CNN report.
At the highest exposure levels, using a mobile phone half an hour a day over a 10-year period, the study found a 40% increased risk of glioma brain tumors.
And number five, bisphenol, a BPA, is linked to male infertility. For years, many conspiracy theorists have been yelling and screaming that a chemical known as bisphenol A that is found in thousands of plastic products is actually really, really bad for us. Well, now some of the mainstream media are starting to jump on board. Back in October, one of the largest UK newspapers published an article entitled Bisphenol A, now linked to male infertility, which made the following unequivocal statement about the dangers of BPA.
Bisphenol A, BPA, known as the gender-bending chemical, because of its connections to male impotence, has now been shown to decrease sperm ability and quality. Number six, prescription drugs kill large numbers of Americans every single year. For years, alternative health practitioners and conspiracy theorists have been asserting that bad reactions to prescription drugs are one of the leading causes of deaths in the United States. Well, the mainstream media is starting to catch up. A recent Vanity Fair article entitled Deadly Medicine began with the following statement. Prescription drugs kill some 200,000 Americans every year. Will the number go up now that most clinical trials are conducted overseas on sick Russians, homeless Poles, slum-dwelling Chinese, in place where regulation is virtually non-existent, the FDA doesn't reach, and mistakes can end up in paupers' graves.
And number seven, the aspartame is not good for our health. Many mainstream news outlets are beginning to wake up to the fact that the artificial sweetener aspartame may not actually be healthy for us. The past summer, Huffington Post, which is usually very mainstream, allowed Dr. Joseph McCullough to author an article about aspartame that began with the following absolute stunning paragraph.
Aspartame is the most controversial food additive in history, and its approval for use in food was the most contested in FDA history. In the end, the artificial sweetener was approved not on scientific grounds, but rather because of a strong political and financial pressure. After all, aspartame was previously listed by the Pentagon as a biochemical warfare agent.
Can you imagine that?
Jesus.
Imagine that, and now it's in everything. Many among the global elite, such as Ted Turner, want to institute a global one-child policy and want to reduce the world population for the good of the environment. And many Americans have a really, really hard time believing that some of the wealthiest, most powerful men in the world actually want to institute a global one-child policy and are obsessed with reducing the population of the Earth. But sadly, as I have written about previously, this is very, very real. And the following is how one major Canadian newspaper summarized public remark that Ted Turner recently made about the global population.
Mr. Turner, a longtime advocate of population control, said, "The environmental stress on the Earth requires radical solutions," suggesting countries should follow China's lead in instituting a one-child policy to reduce global population over time. He added that fertility rights could be sold so the poor people could profit from the decision not to reproduce.
And
sadly, on other health issues, the mainstream media continues to push the establishment agenda very strongly. For example, the mainstream media is absolutely rabid about defending the safety of vaccines. But hopefully, as the alternative media continues to tell the truth about these various health issues, It will cause the American public to demand more balanced reporting from the mainstream media. After all, it's only the health of millions upon millions of Americans that is at risk. When it comes to matters of life and death, you would think that it would not be too much to ask for a little honest reporting.
And we've been harping on this for a long time, Lila and I, and about the vaccines especially. And it was really inspiring to us to note that over 65 or 75% of the educated public in the United States was refusing vaccines.
And that was good.
65, those are people with college education and above, refusing vaccines, including all the medical profession.
Yeah, they don't take it.
They don't take them either because they're
they know what they know what's involved in that stuff.
Right.
They give it to you, but they won't give it to their family. Obama didn't vaccinate his kids.
That's right.
Or himself or his wife, but he wanted you to take the vaccine.
That's right. And we stated that on this show.
That was the flu vaccine, by the way.
That's correct. So the H1N1.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the next, we have our interview coming up right now with, we're going to go a little over tonight.
Ellen Brown.
But that's okay. But we have an interview with Ellen Brown, and author of the Web of Debt, which is a great book, and a journalist and a lawyer, and recently published an article in Huffington Post called Fed 101.
And she really understands the economy.
The Federal Reserve's policies, and I think you'll get quite a bit out of this. I hope you do. And
I know I do every time we have her on. I mean, I learn a lot from her. She really understands
and
things.
And she advocates the centralization of state banks. State banks, and I think that's a great thing. So this is the article. Lila is going to read that the article, and then we'll go into the interview. Okay?
All right. I think you'll find it informative, folks.
Okay.
Article by Ellen Brown, who's going to be our guest on our show, and this was written on the Huffington Post on 12/16/10, and it's What the Fed Can Do, a Banker of Last Resort, Central Banking 101. We've seen behind the curtain as the Fed waved its magic liquidity wand over Wall Street. Now it's time to enlist this tool in the service of the people. The Fed's invisible hand first really became visible with the bailout of AIG. Many of us, this is what Nancy Pelosi said, many of us, shall we say, if not surprised, taken aback when the Fed had $80 billion to invest to put in AIG just out of the blue. All of a sudden, we wake up one morning and AIG has reserved $80 billion from the Fed. So, of course, we're saying, where's this money to come from? Oh, we have it. And not only that, we have more. How much more? $800 billion? $8 trillion? That was the figure recently revealed for the Fed's emergency lending programs to bail out the banks. $12.3 trillion of our taxpayer money, shouted the bemused spectators as pigeons emerged from the showman's glove cans. We could have used that money to build roads and bridges. Not exactly tax money, says the magician with the mysterious Mona Lisa smile. When did you have $12.3 trillion in tax money sitting idle? Not only did he not use tax money, it seemed he hardly used money at all. He just advanced numbers on a computer screen amounting to credit against collateral, replacing the credit that would have been advanced by the money market before the fatal day the money market died. According to CNN Money, the Federal Reserve made $9 trillion in overnight loans to major banks and Wall Street firms during the Wall Street crisis. All the loans were backed by collateral, and all were paid back with a very low interest rate to the Fed, an annual rate of between 0.5% to 3.5%. In addition to the loan program for bond dealers, the data covered the Fed's purchases of more than $1 trillion in mortgages and spending to back consumer and small business loans, as well as commercial paper used to keep large corporations' money. Most of the special programs set up by the Fed in response to the crisis of 2008 have since expired, although it still holds close to $2 trillion in assets it purchased during this time. The Fed said it did not lose money on any of the transactions, or so it's reported to the media. When did the Fed get this remarkable power? Central banks are lenders of last resort, which means they are authorized to advance as much credit as the system requires. It's all keystrokes on a computer, and the supply of this credit is limitless, according to Wikipedia. A lender of last resort is an institution willing to extend credit when no one else will. Why is this backup necessary? Why? Because Wikipedia matter-of-factly states, due to fractional reserve banking in aggregate, all lenders and borrowers are insolvent. The bank lends out some or most of the deposited funds while still allowing all deposits to be withdrawn upon demand. Fractional reserve banking necessarily occurs when banks lend out funds received from deposited accounts and is practiced by all modern commercial banks. All commercial banks are insolvent. They are unable to pay their debts when they come due because they have double-counted their deposits. A less charitable world word, if this hadn't all been validated with legislation, might be embezzlement. The bank has took your money for safekeeping, promising you could have it back on demand, and then borrowed it from the till to clear the checks of their borrowers. Modern banking is a massive shell game, and the banks are in a mad scramble to keep the peas under the shells. If they don't have the peas, they borrow them from other banks or the money market short term until they can come up with some longer term source. Interesting. And Pettifor writes, the banking system has been turned on its head and become a borrowing machine. Rather than lending us their money, they are borrowing from us and lending it back. Banks can borrow from each other at the Fed's rate of 0.2%. They get the very cheap credit and lend it to us at a much more expensive credit rate. They got away with this shell game into 2008 when the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy triggered a run on the money markets. Panicked investors pulled their short-term money out, and the credit market suddenly froze. The shell game would have been exposed for all of us to see if the Federal Reserve had not stepped in and played its lender of last resort card. Quoting Wikipedia again, a lender of last resort serves as a stopgap to protect depositors and prevent widespread panic. In the United States, the Federal Reserve serves as the lender of last resort to those institutions that cannot obtain credit elsewhere, and the collapse of which would have had serious implications for the economy. It took over this role from the private sector clearinghouses, which operated during the free banking era. Whether public or private, the availability of liquidity was intended to prevent bank runs. Here's some creative proposals. According to financial blogger Edward Harrison, he quotes from Bloomberg. Let's see, what is he saying here? We're going to get our guest in a minute. That part isn't important. Let me go over to this next part. I was in the Fed last week in Washington for one of its occasional meetings with academics. The Fed is especially concerned about unemployment and the weak housing market. Quantitative easing remains the only economic show in town, given that Congress and the President Barack Obama have been cowed into inaction. Quantitative easing involves central bank purchases with money created on a computer screen. So, what will they buy? They are limited to only federally insured paper, which includes treasuries and mortgage-backed securities insured by Freddie Mae and Freddie Mac. But they are also allowed to buy short-term municipal bonds, and given the difficulties faced by the state and local governments, this may well be the chosen route, at least for some of the quantitative easing. Even if the Fed wanted to, it couldn't buy other securities such as corporate bonds. You don't need to understand all this financial jargon to pick up that a central banking insider who sat on the Fed's meeting said that for the Fed's next trick, it could and may well fund the bonds of local government. And maybe that's the answer. Is our guest with us?
Yeah. Good evening. Good evening, Ellen. How are you?
Hi.
I'm glad you could make it with us tonight, Matt.
Thanks.
Good evening, Ellen. This is Lila. Welcome to the show. We're glad to have you back.
Hi, Lila.
I was just reading your article, Central Banking 101, What the Fed Can Do, A Banker of Last Resort, and moved into the part where you talked about
the Fed may be bailing out local governments.
Yeah, how practical is that, or how feasible is that for them to do that?
Well, I've just finished another article, which I haven't posted yet,
mm-hmm.
but Ben Bernanke said last Friday that they're not going to bail out local governments. And so he certainly could. That is, there was legislation at least in the between from 1934 to 1958, the Federal Reserve Act provided that basically that the Fed could lend to anybody, but act as a commercial bank. But now they've changed the law, and it's gotten even more restrictive with the Dodd-Frank amendment or the changes of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently they can't. He says he's not going to do it because he can't do it. But it's certainly not because they don't have the money. They came up with $12.3 trillion for the banks during after 2008. I mean, it's just credit. They could have been $120 trillion. They could come up with as much money as they want. All they have to all they're doing is basically giving an overdraft on the account of the borrower to be paid back. So what they're essentially doing is replacing very cheap credit, replacing the expensive credit of the banks, who also just create the credit on their books. That's how they do loans.
Right.
They're replacing that with very cheap credit with the Fed. So what we have here is a two-tiered system that if you're a banker, you can get this very cheap credit. If you're a state or local government, you're stuck. You have to borrow from Wall Street and pay. I think they're averaging.
Now, the Dodd-Frank bill, what did that really do for us?
It doesn't seem like it did much.
Everything else up. I mean,
there were things that looked rather promising, like they were supposed to, if in fact some entity, a large bank, was shown to be a threat to the stability of the system, they could put it into bankruptcy. Or they could break it up. That's what it says. But apparently now, with the more conservative Congress, they're even looking at all that. And I mean, it's just not going to happen. They're going to any progress they did make, they're going to backtrack on. And they changed the language in, I think it was Section 13C or 13.3 that said that in exigent circumstances, that the Fed could lend to businesses and corporations and anybody it wanted to. They changed that language. So now it says only in specified, it's very vague who they can lend to, but clearly they're not going to do it unless.
What I don't understand, one thing, and we talked about this last month when they released, the Fed spent in excess of some stories have gone as high as $12 trillion to foreign to bail out all these foreign banks, all right, as well as companies, all right.
McDonald's was one.
What's
setting up McDonald's and they're not.
They bailed out McDonald's as well.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Verizon was on the list. Yeah.
Wow. So the Fed is not going to be able to step in and help local governments, what is going to be the answer for local governments?
Well, that's my current push is we're starting a public banking institute. I think what the states have to do is set up publicly owned banks just like North Dakota has. In other
right.
words, they have to set up their own credit system where instead of right now, all the state's money, in California, I know the figures for California where I live, the California deposits of the state are all in Wall Street banks. There are seven banks, and six of the seven banks are Wall Street banks. So our money's going out of state. It's going to New York. And then the banks they leverage it and do all those things with it, those magical things that they can do with deposits. Well, we could do exactly the same thing with our own deposits if we kept them in our own state bank.
I think I mentioned this to you the other day when we talked. I know I did, but about the how the mainstream media was ridiculing North Dakota. I saw it on CNN. I saw it on MSNBC. I mean, they were talking about North Dakota like it was some kind of alien planet.
and they had no clue as to why they had 4% unemployment and why they were the strongest economy out of the 50 states, and they were acting like it wasn't like they didn't know. And these were mainstream reporters. Okay, do you find that the mainstream media is as stupid as they present themselves to be in these areas? Because I know you're one of the few people that write about this, these issues, and it seems like it's never picked up. But I mean, it's never talked about in the mainstream. You know, your ideas.
Right. Well, that's why. So we're forming a public banking institute to get these ideas out there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I know. But are you getting any support for this?
I get flooded with email. I mean, people
do,
are really keenly interested. I have 70,000 emails in my Gmail inbox. I just can't get to them.
Oh, my God.
A lot of people know about this. They're just not, like you say, in the mainstream media. And a lot of people are very interested and think that it's the only way out. What else are we going to do? I mean, I did think there was some hope there with the quantitative easing, that they could aim that.
Yeah, whatever happened.
Well, I sent that.
Like that went out the window pretty quickly, didn't it?
Now they've said they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
I sent the article that you wrote last year about the North Dakota banking system to my representative, and of course, I don't think she even read it. And I happened to see her at a local institution and mentioned to her that our state was still had a huge deficit. And why don't you think about forming a state bank? I said, I sent you a very informative article explaining that and why North Dakota was a solvent state and not having the problems that so many states are having. She said, oh, I guess I'll have to resurrect that article. But it didn't seem like she had much interest.
Yeah, she was trying to resurrect her own political life, but at the same time. But the problem is that, you know, there's no momentum in any of these state or federal houses. All right, to do this, is it because obviously the banking lobby?
The banking lobbies control so much
of them, but at the same time, I think 99% of our politicians are virtual numbskulls when it comes to anything financial.
They're owned by bankers and pharmaceutical companies. What's the chance of having a bank in California, do you think? How do things look there, your own state?
Are there several legislators who are interested in bringing a bill now?
Oh, good.
Very interesting things are happening in Sacramento.
Oh, that's
so
great.
We're waiting. I mean, we're trying to give them a lot of feedback. I was recently contacted, like just a couple of days ago, by progressive, was it like the teachers union? I'm not sure. Anyway, it was called Progressive Maryland. And they're keenly interested in bringing a bill. And they said that the Chamber of Commerce was behind it. And it was actually a group of people that called. We had a conference call. He said that when you get the Chamber of Commerce and the progressives on the same side, you're pretty much going to have a bill that sails right through.
I would think so.
Once you understand what we're talking about here, it just almost seems obvious. Like, all our money's going out of state. It's being used by Wall Street banks to create their own money, to create their own credit. They have instant credit lines with each other. They can get credit for almost nothing. We are paying 5% interest. Why? Why don't we have our own bank? Why don't we keep our own money in our own state? In North Dakota, by law, all the state's revenues go into Bank of North Dakota. Also, they are set up as North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota. So technically all the assets of the state are the assets of the bank. So they've got all those requirements covered. They paid a 26% dividend the last time they paid a dividend. So that was to the state. So it's a huge moneymaker for the state. So you could take, for your capital base, for instance, in California, CalPERS, the pension fund, has $200 billion in it, and the treasurer manages a fund with $71 billion in it, and then there are all these rainy day funds around that you certainly wouldn't need them to be the size that they are now if you had an instant credit line instead, like the banks do. So any of those investments, I would think, would jump at the chance to make 26%. I mean, they're making a couple of percent or CalPERS is always taking these huge risks because they have to do it because they have to make 10%, I think it is, to meet their obligations, you know, which were established long ago when interest rates are quite a bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
So they're always sort of the patsy that's getting taken in these deals. So if you had a solid 26% interest investment that you could put your money into that nobody could be upset with because it's the state itself, you're putting your money into a state investment to help the state, I think you would have lots of these different funds that would be eager to get into it.
I would think so.
I mean, it seems like the perfect answer since we're not going to get any help from the Fed.
I just saw an article about Ireland. It was by an Irish person who was complaining about that Ireland had been put back to where they were in the 17th and 18th centuries when they were essentially serfs of England.
Mm-hmm.
And been put back into that state. And he said, I wrote long ago that the solution to this was a state bank. We could put our own money in our own bank and leverage it out the way banks do, and we could make much more money than they supposedly would have gotten work for them at all. Let's put that.
So what's it going to take, Ellen, to do this? I mean, what's it going to take to break these banks and begin our own?
Well, I think the banks are breaking because of the foreclosure thing. There are more and more cases are coming out that MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, breaks the chain of title. So 60% of mortgages or 65 million mortgages are now held in the name of MERS. So if all those mortgages can't be foreclosed upon because MERS really can't hold title and has broken the chain of title, in other words, it's a violation of state property law, if they can't be foreclosed upon, then the banks just don't have the assets that they thought they had, and they're all going to be, or, you know, all those big banks, all those big mortgage banks are going to be teetering on the edge. And
mm-hmm.
I would guess, unless we're just fools, you would think that this time we're not going to bail them out like we did before.
I would hope not. I don't think there's anything left to
do. Let me see if I understand this clearly. They won't be able to foreclose on the people that have defaulted on their mortgages, so that means those people will get those houses free and clear?
That's right. They own the homes free and clear by law. Now, they still owe money. Because they've signed a promissory note, so they owe money to someone. What I would recommend, and that's another thing we want to do with our public banking institute, is I want to give some legal advice here. I'm a lawyer, but I can't take these cases, but I could suggest generally what people can do. If you're representing yourself, if you're in foreclosure, you're probably broke, so you probably can't afford a lawyer, but you can copy some other people's pleadings, which is exactly how lawyers do it anyway. They just copy pleadings. That's what litigation is all about. So find somebody who won their case and copy their pleadings and go in for declaratory relief. So you're basically saying to the court, you could have two causes of action. You would go in and say, the first count would be for declaratory relief for quiet title. So you want a declaration to say, there are all these cases that say that MERS breaks the chain of title. MERS is on my chain of title, and so I would like a declaration from the court that we own our home free and clear, or that MERS does not have standing to foreclose. And then for your second cause of action, say you go in equity, which means it's the other, they don't have legal grounds to take your house, but equitably, somebody, you owe some money to somebody, so you go into inequity on your second count for, and say, we acknowledge that we owe money to somebody, we've signed this promissory note, but we don't know who it is, because it's investors, you know, it's all these investors
mm-hmm.
that have shifted their, that was the whole point of setting up this electronic registration system, was that they could keep changing hands with these properties without having to re-record every time, which would have cost a huge amount of money. But essentially, they were doing tax fraud because those recordings are taxes, and they were avoiding all that. But they were also hiding who really owns the stuff. So you can't tell who you owe money to. So you're saying if somebody steps forward and proves that they're out the money that we used to buy our house, we acknowledge that we owe that and we'll pay it or whatever, go bankrupt or whatever you have to do to settle that issue.
Now, how long is that open? What if you can't find who it is?
That's it. They're not most. The investors aren't going to be able to prove that they're out the money. For one thing, many of these claims have been paid in credit default swaps. These are a form of
insurance.
It's sold as a form of insurance. So they've already protected their interest with credit default swaps, and the counterparties have paid up. So
now, what is
that? Twice in equity. If you don't, you have to show damages. You have to show that you've lost the money. And if you can't show that, you don't have a claim against the other party. And then, even if you can show your money, how are you going to show that this particular piece of property was the piece of property that your money went to? So it's going to be so the investors basically have a huge claim against the banks that set these deals up that were too vague to really prosecute on, and the homeowners have claims. So the banks are the ones that should legally be caught in the middle that are going to have to settle up, and of course they can't. They don't unless the government steps in.
Now we have eight.
So then, I just want to know what will happen to the individual homeowner then. So how long will something like that be open for somebody to make a claim against them, saying that they still owe money? Is that ad infinitum, or is it 5 years? Or
yeah, it's. I think it's 5 years from. I'm trying to remember. Sorry, I haven't done litigation for a while. Or is it? There is a limit. Maybe it's 4 years on a written contract, but it's after notice.
Okay.
So, if you're only now giving notice, like even though you signed the contract 10 years ago,
right,
that wouldn't matter because you've been paying on it all along. So I think it's 4 years from breach. I'll have to look that up on a written contract.
Now, under these default derivatives or credit swaps or whatever. How deep is the taxpayer into this AIG? Now, AIG was the insurance companies that insured.
It was a reinsurance.
Yeah, reinsurance company that insured this these mortgages or these mortgage-backed securities. Is that correct?
Huh?
So now, the taxpayer, the U.S. taxpayer, now owns 80% of AIG. And we were the ones that bailed out.
The taxpayers paid on the other side of those credit default swaps. We
right.
have a good claim on those properties. And so that would be we the public.
Right.
So it seems to me that we the public could go in and buy up the...
That's what I wondered, yeah. I mean, we already did buy them up, basically,
to,
yeah.
If you nationalize these bankrupt banks,
yeah,
they really should be. I mean, that's what they do in Europe all the time with bankrupt banks. That's what they're doing in Ireland. They're going to find themselves with a bunch of nationalized banks pretty soon, and they could turn around and just turn that into one big state bank and start doing banking for themselves and tell the IMF to go away, just like Iceland did.
Now this big
they'll probably be a lot better off.
Now this big WikiLeaks thing that was supposed to come out, I didn't see anything on it, but something about Bank America or Citigroup, one of those was supposed to be. Was supposed to be targeted by WikiLeaks, and it could prove their downfall. But I don't know. Have you heard anything more on that?
I know Bank of America is probably the next big one to go down.
Oh.
And Bank of America is not a Wall Street bank. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
What we're going to be left with is J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs.
Mm.
Or maybe, and Citigroup might drop out too. I bet it's
yeah, just be Goldman Sachs. That's all that'll be left.
So Bank of America was originally a California bank, and then they moved to somewhere in the South, South Carolina or something like that. And they were stuck with, they were forced really to take, first they were forced to take, I'm not thinking of the name, the big mortgage broker, the one bankrupt.
Countrywide?
Yeah, Countrywide. And then they were forced to take Merrill Lynch.
Oh.
So who forced them? We don't know. But presumably they were already bankrupt. I mean, they're a zombie bank.
Hmm.
And so...
Oh, you mean Bank of America was already a zombie bank?
Well, I mean, how could they... Yeah, because they already were... I'm forgetting the details, but I think they were already laying workers off, and they didn't have the money in anyway to continue with what they were doing, and suddenly they shelled out the money to buy Countrywide. And then they were forced to buy Merrill Lynch. You know, that was when their CEO was let go because he resisted on that or something.
But what, wasn't that a Fed deal? Wasn't that orchestrated between the White House and the Fed?
Yeah, well, I'm assuming,
yeah,
it would be the Treasury and the Fed that probably leaned on them to do that. But why did they pick Bank of America as opposed
to I thought that was odd,
Morgan? Probably because J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs pretty much control.
Now, Wells Fargo was also on the watch list there, too, isn't it?
Wachovia
went under.
Wasn't
that Wachovia too?
That are all considered too big to fail. But if they fail, we can't afford to keep any of them. And that's what's in the new Dodd-Frank thing. That
right.
If those prove to be a systemic risk to the system, that they can be broken up, and that's what should happen. They're not that. They shouldn't be that big, but I'll bet that the only ones left are going to be J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
What about the foreign banks? How do they play in this?
Bank of Scotland.
Like the Bank of Scotland and the Deutsche Bank.
Well, but I think that was probably reasonable because they need dollars. You know, they need those, what are they called, euro dollars? They're trading in dollars in Europe. And they're short on dollars, and so they all have accounts with the Federal Reserve.
Now, I read this article about, I'm not sure if you had written it or had written a follow-up to it, but it was about the deflation of the, deflation, the quantum easing, all right, So somebody had called it a new financial nuclear war, is what happened. And Obama had gone over to was pushing this on the G20, and telling them that they were going to because China and Russia and other countries are trying to get out of using the dollar.
Right.
But they decided through this quantum easing, they were going to basically flood the world market with dollar bills, all right, and virtually making it impossible for them to get out of it. Is that still in the works, or is that still going on, or has it stopped? Or?
Well, I don't know. I would doubt that that's what's happening. The fact is that the dollar is pretty much the world's reserve currency, and there aren't enough dollars, and that's what they were complaining about, that they needed these dollars to conduct trade, and so the Fed provided them by printing them in the same way that it provided the credit for the U.S. banks. But those were, again, they were just loans. They weren't just printing dollars and handing them over. That's why, I mean, if you think about it, how could they possibly have done $12.3 trillion and not have put the system in hyperinflation, but they didn't. In fact, they were still in deflation. In other words, the money supply is shrinking. How can that be?
I don't understand that. Yeah, exactly. That's a good, very good question.
Well, it is all they did, they didn't print money and hand it over. What they did was they just extended credit. It was like, it's like overdraft coverage on the accounts of these banks. And they were typically one-day loans. I mean, they're real quick, and then they pay them off again. So that doesn't affect the money supply. All they're doing is extending cheap credit. Basically, they're just replacing expensive credit with cheap credit.
So if let's go back to the state banks, because that's what really affects most Americans. If we have state banks founded and working in the various states for our American citizens, how will that improve the lives of most ordinary citizens here in America, do you think?
Well, in North Dakota, they have the lowest unemployment rate in the country.
Okay.
And the lowest default rate. So let's assume we followed that model.
Mm-hmm.
In California, what we could do, in North Dakota, they have $4,000 per capita on deposit in the Bank of North Dakota. And so, you know, they're a pretty small population. So if you projected that onto California, we have 137 million people. And so if you multiplied that by 4,000, the bank would have $148 billion in deposits. And in North Dakota, they do it about 1-to-1, so they have about the same amount in loans as they have in deposits. So it's a little less. So let's say we would have $142 billion in credit capacity of this new bank. So what could you do with $142 billion? First of all, you could refinance the deficit. California has a $27 billion deficit.
Mm-hmm.
So you could refinance that at basically 0% interest. In other words, if you fund your own debt, you get the interest back, so it's
right. Essentially
interest-free. So we don't have to worry about the deficit anymore. In fact, we could go farther into deficit, just like the federal government does, as long as the only problem with the deficit is the interest. And if you don't have to pay the interest, you can roll the deficit over indefinitely. And that's only $27 billion. You've still got this another $120 billion or so. You could use that, like, to make one of those maglev trains that goes from San Diego to Sacramento, let's say. And then, so essentially you're just doing credit. So you're building all this stuff on credit. Put people back to work.
You just continually rebuild your infrastructure and have your state be, make sense.
State of the art.
Yeah, I mean,
you could do amazing things. All those things that we used to do in California,
mm-hmm.
when we were like Silicon Valley, cutting edge of creativity. We could create all those things again. We've got the labor. We've got the materials. The only thing we're missing is the money. But what is the money? It's just credit. So we can create our own credit, put people to work, pay them with credit. You're still
mm-hmm.
paying them with dollars, but they're dollars in their accounts. It's sort of like paying them with credit cards. You don't have to print dollars to do it. You're just extending credit. Then you build the train. You charge fees for it. And the fees go back and pay off the loan. So it's a sustainable system. You extend the credit first, build the stuff, and whatever you built, what it generates pays back.
Well, it makes so much sense, and I hope that our states take advantage of such good wisdom.
What bothers me is in so many states, what they're doing is they're actually selling off so much of the infrastructure.
Self-defeating.
Yeah,
oh, very.
It is. It's
what are they going to sell next year? It's like selling off grandma's jewelry. Now what are you going to sell?
Yeah. Yeah, they're selling off highways. So
highways and bridges and all kinds of things.
And all we have to do is just set up our own banks here in the state, and bango, presto, abracadabra, we're solvent.
Parked at a restaurant. I was traveling up in Walnut Creek, and we parked in front of a restaurant. The meters are 1 hour, and you can only do it for an hour. In other words, you can't come out and feed the meter for another hour. You have to move your car. Well, you know your restaurant meal is going to take longer than an hour, so every car in the street had a ticket.
Yeah.
Because nobody came out. I mean, not every car, but, you know, there were a lot of tickets out there because nobody came out and moved their car after an hour. And that's privatized. They can do whatever they want. Now, with the meters, they privatized the meters.
I can't understand why these our municipalities and governments just don't wise up over these things, but I don't know.
Well, I think that people get used to doing business one way, and they can't see, they're not innovative or creative, and it's very easy to be bought out by the big banks. Just easy to accept and have things the way they are, and that's the way it is.
Is that what you're finding, or is it just...
so many people get real depressed because they think there's no way out, and it's complete. And then when you realize that maybe there is a way out, it's quite exciting and interesting.
Oh, absolutely.
It is just a matter of opening your vision a little to the possibilities. If Wall Street can pull this off, why can't we pull it off?
I think we can. And I salute you for bringing this out and getting people to think a little bit and act. I hope the next part will be getting them to act, and we'll put people back to work, and a lot of Americans will be very happy.
Now, do you have a new book coming out, or have you got?
I'm working on it. I hope to have it out this spring, but man, I'm so busy.
The Web of Debt was a classic, and you know, all your work has been just remarkable. And I urge everybody. Well, are you publishing regularly in the Huffington Post now, or?
I have been trying to do an article a week, but since we've been doing this Public Banking Institute, it's kind of slowed me up, and Christmas slowed me up, but I have one right now that I'm hopefully getting up tomorrow or the day after.
Oh, very good.
Well, we look forward to reading it, and we look forward to your book. We thank you for coming on the show, Ellen.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay. Good night.
Bye. And you can go to check out webofdebt.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's your website.
Ellen Brown.
Ellen R. Brown. And we thank Ellen for being on.
We sure do. She makes so much sense.
Oh, doesn't she, though?
And it would be just an answer to the prayer for a lot of states. Please talk.
All right. That was Ellen Brown and our interview with her. And I hope that hope you enjoyed that. Join me tomorrow when we get into the metaphysical aspects of of whatever we'll be talking about tomorrow. So please join me, and hope you have a good night. Thanks for listening.